Good afternoon and welcome to the February 24th, 2016 Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. The first item that we have is the minutes from our previous meeting. And members, those were available in your packets that you have in front of you. Any corrections to those minutes? Senator Johnson moves approval of the minutes from the February 3rd and 4th meetings of the Pension Commission. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. The next item that we have on our agenda, item number two, is MSRS, and I'll ask Mr. Bergstrom to come forward. And it has to do with the privatization of certain employees in dealing with the Fairview University of Minnesota et al. Mergers. And Mr. Bergstrom, I'm going to go ahead and ask you to introduce yourself for the commission and then proceed with your testimony and your presentation. And members, if I am not mistaken, we should all have one of these. And members of the public, Mr. Bergstrom's presentation is also available in a handout on the back counter if you would like to get a copy of that as well. And so, members, that should have been at our spots here. And with that, Mr. Bergstrom, welcome, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And this will be somewhat of a controversial proposal, as we found out since we notified people, and it's really an issue of perspective. MSRS is approaching it from the perspective of what the employees at Fairview received, and obviously the employees are approaching it from what we're proposing that we would reduce. So it's really one of perspective. So if you turn, you do have a handout on page two, just a very brief history. And I will take full blame for this because I was here when it's created, so I can't blame this on anybody but me or anybody else. In 1996, the University of Minnesota Hospital was sold to Fairview. At that time, MSRS was 107% funded. Our employee and employer contributions were 4%. At the time, there were about 2,700 employees that were affected. And there was a lot of pressure to keep the employees in MSRS at the time. You know, the unions and the employees wanted to maintain their pension coverage. Unfortunately, with the IRS, you cannot have private employees covered by a public pension plan. So that was not feasible. And because MSRS was overfunded at the time, when Fairview employees were no longer eligible to participate, there was an actuarial gain that accrued to the fund because we were overfunded and we had projected future growth and benefits, and that had ended. So the employees were really concerned that the merger would reduce their retirement benefits. So the purpose in the legislation, and I won't read this because the idea was that the benefits that they got were commensurate with the prior contributions made by them and on their behalf by the integration of University of Minnesota Hospital. So the founding legislation is in front of you, the purpose of the legislation, and the legislation was intended so that they would get the value of their contributions that they had contributed and not lost anything. From my perspective, we have achieved that in almost all cases and actually exceeded that in most cases, and that's why we are here today. So more directly, MSRS got involved in a process, and just on a very high level, the idea behind the proposal was to enhance MSRS benefits, and when combined with the defined contribution offered by Fairview, it would be somewhat equal to what they would have gotten had they stayed in MSRS. So that was kind of conceptually what was attempted back then, was to protect the benefits of the employees leaving. So this was something that was negotiated with various parties, with MSRS, and then was put in legislation. So this is something that did get a lot of discussion, and it was something that MSRS supported, MSRS, you know, helped. And I want to stress, MSRS was very concerned about the employees as well at the time. What has happened over time is that, well, before I do that, on page five, what the law did is it protected the rule of 90 benefits for employees. A lot of the employees were just maybe a couple of years away from the rule of 90, so they granted eligibility. The service credit they had with Fairview counted towards eligibility. The All of the employees were immediately vested. So even if they had 1 or 2 months of service credit, they automatically were vested. And really what has caused the issue in front of you today is the third item. We enhanced benefits back then by 3% for most of our employees. If they leave state government, we increased their pension by 3% to 55 and then 5% thereafter. Now in 2010, we lowered that to 2% for everybody prospectively, but we did not touch this group. Back in 1996, the actuarial gain that we had, they said, well, let's augment those benefits even further. They said, let's give them 5.5% before age 55 and 7.5% thereafter. So they received 2.5% more than an average typical employee who left their service and left public service.
Mr. Bergstrom, just for clarification, when you're talking about the 5.5% and the 7.5%, would that be percentage per year of their high five, as we normally would call it, or final 5 years of services? Is that what I'm understanding?
So Mr. Chair, what we do is we calculate their benefits using their high five in years of service, and then every year you increase that by 5.5% until 55. The next year, so, you know, the first year out, it's 5.5. The next year, you take that new base and do 5.5. Once they're over 55, then it started increasing at 7.5% per year. So it's actually an increase in their benefits to the plan.
So, Mr. Bergstrom, again, just to provide some clarification for the public and for members of the commission, if an individual worked for 10 years under this plan before the buyout, can you explain how that 10 years at the University of Minnesota would be handled, and then we'll add that next component? Just so I thought there may be like an example or working example for us versus just the numbers, if you could help us with something of that type.
Yep. So let's take 10 years of service. The formula at the time was 1.5% for each year of service. And so assuming full retirement age, we calculated the 10 years would be 15% times their high five average salary. So that's the base calculation.
Mm-hmm.
That came up with a dollar amount. Then we took that dollar amount of benefit and we increased that every year until they begin to collect the benefit.
So, Mr. Bergstrom, someone could still remain in employment at Fairview after the privatization and still be entitled to that benefit. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, as long as it would continue regardless of whether they stayed at Fairview, they got the enhanced augmentation. They did lose it if they went back to other public service, and we will talk about that in a little bit. But essentially, they all got it as long as they didn't return to any public service.
Mr. Bergstrom, my mind is starting to run a little bit on this. Is it possible someone could be drawing more than 100% of their wage as a result of this augmented benefit?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing they potentially could.
When you're starting to talk about the numbers, and you said that it would continue, I was just curious if you had an answer to that.
And I do have some numbers for examples
to
share a little bit later as well.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Bergstrom.
So, Mr. Chair, what has happened, if you double at 5.5%, benefits double roughly every 13 years. At 7.5%, benefits double every 9.6 years.
Mr. Chair, are we on page 6 now, Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, yes.
Okay.
So I just put an example. It's just made up just to give the impression of compounding. So just take an employee who was 40 at the time, and they had earned a benefit using that formula we had calculated of $800. That employee's benefit has doubled once to $1,600 at age 53 and will double again to about $3,200 at age 64. Some of these employees are still in their late 30s, early 40s. Under the current law, they will double not once more, but twice more. And that is part of the concern, is when you keep doubling the benefits, it starts to run into a problem. Effective 2012, the benefits...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
The example here gives you, in terms of the equation, age. But what would be a commensurate salary, annual salary, that would derive initially for an $800 annual benefit?
Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I didn't back into that. I just took an example. And I do have some specific examples later that will show you exactly what their salary was as we get there. I just wanted to illustrate the issue of compounding.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Proceed.
Effective 2012, MSRS did reduce the deferred augmentation to 2% for all of its members, along with the other pension plans. Some went down to 1, some went down to 0. And currently, our contribution rate is 5.5, and we're proposing to go to 6. What our proposal is to lower augmentation to 2% for Fairview employees effective January 1 of 2017. It would maintain the augmentation earned to date, so it would not take away anything they have already received. Prospectively, we would lower it. It would slow the future growth of benefits, and the 2% is the same that we use for all of our deferred members. The other issue that we have found on a separate note is that Fairview employees who return to, let's say, TRA or PERA, under current law, their augmentation just flat out stops until when they come back. And we actually think that might be unfair for some of the employees, and we'd like to correct that too, because they would actually lose money. I talked to a gentleman the other day. He worked for 3 years at TRA, or just under 3 years, didn't vest. And because of that, he lost hundreds of dollars a month in augmentation. So there are about 100 people who may be affected by that. So that group, we would actually think they need some more preservation, and I can talk more about that later. So how many are affected, and what does this really impact? Of the current employees...
You're now on page 8?
Yep.
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
So as of July 1 of 2015... we have about 1,400 employees who are still impacted by this. The average age of the employees is 56, and the average years of covered service is 9. We put a breakdown by age and average service credit below. So we still have 109 members between 35 and 44, 430 between 45 and 54, and 784 between 55 and 64 and 82. Between 64 and 74. So the rest of them have already retired. So many of these people have already retired and begun collecting monthly benefits. So that just gives you a snapshot. To the benefits side, so we put in chart form that talks a little bit more about the questions that have been asked, and we just randomly picked members. So the first member currently is age 62. They had 22 years of service. Their high five salary was $3,551. For that person, they had contributed total employee and employer $46,749. Under the current law, that person would get $5,227 a month, assuming retirement at 65. I'm sorry. Under the proposal law, they would still get $4,575. A typical state employee who left service would get $2,085. So if you look at the comparison, over on the red, we actually still get payroll for the employees of Fairview. We looked at what their benefit would be had they just continued to pay into MSRS. So member A would currently have a benefit of $3,637. Plus would have contributed now a total of $138,000. And it just puts into perspective that, quite frankly, some of these employees are getting more than they would be if they continued working and had paid into the fund all of the year.
Mr. Bergstrom, another question, just again for clarification for the commission and others. Because the University of Minnesota Hospitals was privatized or sold or merged with Fairview, those employees are now classified as private employees versus government employees. Does Fairview also offer, to your knowledge, other retirement benefit plans like a defined contribution plan that these individuals would be participating in as well, or was that in lieu of that type of a benefit, or so shed some light there?
No, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the University of, even if they're in Fairview, they contribute to a 403B and a 401K. We online checked in that employer contribution for some, and we tried to confirm that these employees were eligible, but we did not get a call back. So we tried for 2 days. So the employer contribution, if someone put in 6% of their salary would have been up to 7%, at least online. I could not verify that these employees were covered by that, so I can't address that. But that's online what their benefit coverage. So it, going back to the original intent was that their MSRS benefit that was enhanced plus their 401k contributions would somewhat equal what they were going to get from MSRS. And you know, in almost all of the cases we've looked at, we've more than achieved that goal.
So, Mr. Bergstrom, well, you may not have the specifics. You're comfortable that there is a plan at Fairview or some kind of deferred contribution
yep.
plan that employees can participate in?
Yep. Mr. Chair, online, it has their employee benefits, and that's how we found it.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that in the memo that I prepared that sets forth some of the background, I found an excerpt and included it from the purchase agreement at the time. And at that time, apparently, the state, in the negotiations regarding the spinoff, made sure that both a pension plan and a 403b plan would be offered to these employees, and they were given service credit for their period of time with the state. So it wasn't a pension plan in the defined benefit sense. It was a money purchase pension plan, which is a defined contribution plan that requires a certain level of contribution. I understand that plan was frozen in 2010, I believe, but the 403B is ongoing.
So Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bergstrom,
you know, just so if you go across the examples, I won't go through all of them because I think you get the idea. So, like, I'll just take Member G, for example. They're currently age 60. They had about 18 years of service. The high five salary back then was $2,639. The total employee and employer contribution was $31,856. Half of that would have been the employees. The current law benefit would be $3,272. With the proposed law, it would be $2,698. Again, a typical state employee who had left state government would have be at $1,449. This person would have been higher had they contributed to MSRS all that time, but they also would have paid in another $140,000. So, again, these are just examples of people that we randomly picked. And Mr. Chair, that's the issue, is the intent to me has been met. I think it has actually, in most cases, been more than achieved. And the real issue here is if we keep doubling this for someone 40, now we have to, they just keep growing and growing at that rate. So, Mr. Chair, at a time where we have cut benefits, at a time where we're asking employees to pay them more, this is just something that we looked at. The financial impact on MSRS, and I have included, I have given the staff the actuarial work for that, and I believe they've distributed. So if you turn to page 10, the liabilities for current Fairview members are about $251 million. Under this proposal, it lowers it to 192, which is a total reduction of liabilities of $58,604,000. If you equate that to a percent of pay, if we needed to charge all current employees, that would be a 0.14% contribution rate. So if this were enacted, you know, the required contributions would drop by be 0.14% less. Now, that's at a time when we're asking for more, but that would be the impact on the roughly 50,000 active members that we have.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Bergstrom, so in 2012, when MSRS reduced the deferred augmentation to 2% for all its members, why wasn't Fairview considered at that time?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, at the time, we had so much on our agenda that we decided that we just didn't have time to tackle it all. I will be honest, Mr. Martin, when he was here, asked if we wanted to after the legislation was, and I just at the time said no. Mm-hmm. We also wanted to study it further. We wanted to put some thought into it. In retrospect, I probably would have done it, but mm-hmm. you know, at this point, again, when we're asking members to step up, employers to step up, and COLA cuts, we just thought this might be an appropriate time to bring it forward.
Mr. Bergstrom. Anything else to share with the commission at this point?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, have questions for Mr. Bergstrom at this time? Mr. Bergstrom, we're going to ask you to stay by, close by, because there probably will be some questions that may be coming forward on that. We did have some people who did ask to testify, and I'm going to go with that list of individuals, and I'm going to start out with Representative Kahn as our first testifier. Representative Kahn has some experience with a pension commission and also has some experience at the time that this merger happened, and she would like to share the wisdom and benefit of that experience with the commission this afternoon. Representative Kahn, welcome to the committee or commission that you are very familiar with, as having served on this as well.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead and state your name for the record and begin with your comments.
Representative Phyllis Kahn, District 60B. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Of course, I so miss all those long hours associating with this wonderful group of people. Can't imagine how much it adds to your life.
You're not helping us, Representative Kahn.
She's sincere. She's not sarcastic.
So, anyway, I think I'm the only person close to this table who was on the Pension Commission when this was, when this was done. And, as is pointed out and as reading the memos from Ms. Leszczewski and also listening to Mr. Bergstrom, it's a terribly complicated issue, and it's really hard to go through anything. But what I remember of it was that this pension issue was the only thing that was really standing in the way of the merger. And I don't believe that the merger could have existed without tremendous pushback. And this agreement was come to get rid of the pushback from the MSRS, from the university pension covered employees, from the MSRS, obviously covered employees. And I don't, obviously, when you look at the language, in perpetuity was not written into it. And as is pointed out, the legislature can always change its mind. But I want to assure the members that at the time that this was being done, it was assumed that it was an in perpetuity agreement, that this covered these employees for the rest of their career. And there was a great deal of relief because the university in Fairview really wanted this to happen. There was a great deal of relief at the time that this obstacle to the agreement was removed and that this agreement was received. And so that's all, I know it's not the same as having written it into the law, but that's exactly what my understanding of it was at the time. And I don't recall anyone ever raising the issue of would this be removed at some point in the future. So,
questions? Representative Kahn, thank you. Looks like Representative Kreisha would like to maybe follow up with that. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, welcome. I could move that you become an honorary member if you'd like to join us again. One question, just so I have some historical perspective. Had that merger not happened, would have there been benefit? What was the benefits to the employees for the merger? I'm assuming this was not the only benefit for those that kept their jobs. I don't know the historical context of it. So,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fisher, I'm not sure there was any visible benefit to the merger. It was kind of a merger on paper and so forth, and I think they were used to being university employees, and I think that's what they wanted to be. And the merger was just kind of, I can't remember that. The merger was obviously to put these two operations together was a benefit to healthcare, and it was saving money and all of these things. And I'm sure that all of those points were raised. But I do remember, because the only committee I was on that was concerned with this was the Pension Commission. And so my memory of it is that if the pension issue had not have been settled, I don't believe the merger would have gone through.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't know if you want to comment on this or not, Representative Kahn, but it just seems to me odd that neither the university or Fairview continued to carry any of the liability at all. All the liability was on the MSRS fund and ultimately the other members of the fund. So,
well, you know.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, I think if you came to a solution that told the university in Fairview that they should kick into the solution, I think that that would be perfectly acceptable. I don't remember it. You know, for example, I think it wasn't considered to be an inappropriate burden on MSRS. I certainly don't remember any testimony at the time that it was. So I don't remember that issue coming back. But I think looking at it now, I think to say that maybe the university and Fairview should participate in this solution would be an appropriate thing to do. But again, I don't know. It's not, I don't, you know, that's why I'm not on this pension commission anymore. It's your problem. I'm just trying to give you the advice, what I remember from what the discussion was in the past.
Senator Pappas, follow-up? Mm-hmm. Members, any other questions for Representative Kahn? Well, thank you, Representative Kahn, for being here and providing us with some of your recollections on the discussions before the commission today.
Okay.
We had a few other what I will call interested parties who have stepped forward wanting to participate and share their views as well with the commission. And I have four or five people that are on the list right now, and I'm going to invite them to come forward. And when you do, when I do call you, ask you to come in, I'll recognize you, ask you to identify yourself for the record. And then Lisa will also ask you to sign in so we have a permanent record of who it was with the spelling of your name as you were testifying before the commission today. And so with that, the next party that I have on here is a Gail or Dan Stormquist. Stormquist, excuse me.
I think both.
Welcome to the commission, and I'm going to, in a moment, ask you each to state your name for the record, and as questions may arise or things happen, you've kind of seen, I'll recognize you, and then I'll kind of connect the two people who have the question and those types of things. What I'm going to ask that you do, and how we oftentimes will work with these things, is if Mr. Bergstrom has shared some information, if Representative Kahn has shared some information, you can refer to, they've made that point. The commission now is looking to find other information to help them make the decision. So if you have additional information to share with us to help us to better background and understand that, that's what we'd like to be able to hear. So with that, welcome to the commission. Go ahead and identify yourselves for the record, and then we'll have each of you go ahead and give your input to the commission.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gail Stromquist.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, as well. I'm Daniel Stromquist.
And who's going to go first, or?
Daniel's going to, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Daniel's going to speak, and I'm just going to help keep notes, or if you have questions, write down in case he didn't hear them.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Stromquist, go ahead and present your thoughts to the commission, if you would.
Do you have my statement? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, have some figures, and I've looked at what they've provided, and and thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the merged Fairview employees. I think you're going to hear from a few more of them, so I'm going to dispense with arguing about some of these points here. And David Bergstrom sure has covered very thoroughly, I thought, as well as the proposal. I've read the proposal, and I think that covers a lot of the points as well. excuse me, I'm not a real good public speaker here, but
just relax. You're doing a great job. Just relax.
So far, so good.
Doing well.
The first 10 stories, no problem. All right. All we really had to go on here up until yesterday, or maybe it was Monday night, was the proposal itself. And so we quickly tried to go over that. And a couple of weeks ago, the letter was received, and so There was 2,600 of them, I believe. That's correct, isn't it? And 1,300 of them are still left. And so what you've got is a very small group, and what I believe is not really a normal pension group, looking at what happened in the history of it all here. They were created. There was a special statute created and passed. And it's important to realize that, at least from the perspective of employees, is why that statute was written. And yes, they've quoted it in here very eloquently, I thought, but if you read the first part of it, it says to assure to as much as possible the employees that this pension was permanent. And I guess, in my opinion, and I might not be very popular with some of the other members around here, but I do believe that there is some sort of adjustment that needs to be made in all these benefit plans and this group. It just seems to me that everybody else has taken a hit. They should take a hit as well. The issue I got here, and really what the problem is here, at least from my perspective, is we've looked at the numbers too, and a lot of them are taken. It's not equitable. A lot of them are taking hits of 0%, some of them all the way up to 71%. I intend to show you some of those figures here in a moment. And also, we've tried to figure out, by looking at the few examples we had, what the normal member was going to take for a hit. And from the people that I have, you can see, I believe, I'm going to have you look at your handout now if you can find that package. It's the one that's about a foot thick.
Mr. Stromquist, I'm just going to hold it up so that members can see which one we're looking at.
And let's address the front of that first. There's some mistakes on here, and I'm not here to pick apart the letter and the mistakes, but on the first line, that they're saying that it was a 5.5% increase. No, that was 2.5. And then at age 55, yes, it was a 2.5 from over and above what the $50,000 in the pension plan were getting. So I thought it was just a little sloppy there, and I'll leave it to you on decide on how that got in there. But that's the way it is. Down below, let's look at down below. Here's what I really take an exception with, and here's where our numbers diverge from their numbers. And it says, and if you want to read it, it says 20 years of compounding increases at the current rates have increased pension benefits beyond what they would have had members remained a public employee contributing to a retirement plan. I'm just not comfortable with that statement. And so what we did is we went back and we tried to find some normal employees and run their numbers. And let's take a look at page 3, 4, and 5. Maybe if I hold it up, you can see one of them. I tried to make it as simple, as clear as possible, so there wouldn't be a lot of questions on it, but what this shows...
Mr. Stromquist, just again for helping people to guide, I think I saw you hold up a page that maybe at the top says comparison of employers and pensions who stayed with the state. Is that the heading across the top of the page you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
actually, there's three examples here, and these are from real employees, and so I hope you're... I guess I only got two of them on mine, so we didn't do such a great job with the packet. But what they do is they compare what this employee, who you understand moved to Fairview and has a different salary altogether and everything's changed over there, what this employee would have been making or would have received based upon their salary at age 65 for a pension, and down below is what their augmentation is. So in the first example, I believe it shows 1735 and 1204, line 1 and line 2. Which one? Which copy do they have?
I don't know. That's my only copy.
Oh, you, Mr. Stromquist, I think that's actually the next page because they both look like they're titled the same. We were both correct when we were talking about the same thing. So it looks like it's the next page in that says 1735 and 1204. Am I correct?
You are correct,
okay,
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Okay, thank you, sir.
I'll bring that to the attention of my secretary over here when we get home.
Missing a page on my desk.
We are. The point is that what this shows is a real employee. And what it does show and what the point of the whole matter is that the augmentation for this employee is nowhere near what their pension would be if they've stayed with the state. They were intended to make up some of the what they would lose if they went with Fairville, but not the whole amount. And what's disturbing is MSRS is saying that's just the opposite. And they present multiple examples, and I believe those examples are on page 7. Let me hold it up so everybody can see what it is.
And Mr. Stromquist, is that the one that says on the top left, example set 1?
Example set 1, that's correct. Mr. Bergstrom so eloquently went across and explained to you what the divergence is, what the difference is. And if you look in column 7 and column 9 and column 6 and column 9 and compare those two figures, what he is saying there under current law at the top line, let's look at the top one, the 5,227 versus the 3,637, he's saying that under current law, the benefit that person would receive, the pension, would be 3,637. And the augmented pension would be 5,227. What he doesn't tell you is that this person's salary used to do that is basically flat. Actually, there's a small increase, and I've given you those figures. This person if you look on the 96 column, you'll see it's 42,000, and on the 11th column, it's 64,000. This person, for one reason or another, pardon me.
Some of the employees were demoted.
Gail was actually there, but Gail was actually there, and many of these employees were demoted. And this is an example of a demoted employee. I don't think it's a good representation of what an employee would be making. Most of these people, the ones we looked at, their salaries doubled and tripled. I use the triple figure, and this pension should be really 7,244, double what they show in line 9. So I've got a real problem with that. In my examples that I've given you, the three examples that I've given you, that we just looked at prior to this, those show a real employee and what that employee is getting. So for them to make, I guess the whole point is, for them to make a statement that 20 years of compounding have increased benefits for public employees beyond what they would have had as a retirement benefit with the University of Minnesota or the state of Minnesota, I just don't get it. I don't think they've told the whole story there. That's a demoted employee. And by the way, just for the record, they're started out with 2,600. They're down to 1,300. There's a reason for that. A lot of these people got fired. They quit. They had to actually go back to Fairview and reapply for their jobs. And when they reapplied for their jobs, rather than get fired and just get let go, they took clerk jobs. A lot of them are clerk jobs. Gail was one. She's an analyst with them. She performed services as a clerk for 6 months till they finally said, "Oh, I can't live without you," and they brought her back. So I know that's true because that happened to our family. Mr. Chair.
In keeping with the time that we have for the committee on this and the others that need to testify, I want to just summarize and ask if there's any other points that you want to make. Number one, you're saying that maybe the numbers that Mr. Bergstrom put forward were different than some of the other numbers that you have, so we should take a closer look at some of those. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then if you can add some additional information that the commission doesn't already know, I'll give you about 2 more minutes, and then I need to bring the next testifier up. Thank you,
all right,
sir.
I didn't come here just to argue the points that came here with a proposal and a compromise proposal. I think it's a good one. So rather than, it was not my intent to sit and bash figures and numbers on a statement. So I must say I do take objection to some of his numbers, and you've heard it. But here's my proposal. And I think it's been well noted that the actuaries calculated an actuarial gain in 96, so I guess that means that some of this was paid for. But this small group, most of these employees, and if you look at their stats, I think they bear me out, are around, can you show that?
Yeah, on page 12.
No. On MSRS, they give you some stats, maybe it's on page 8, yeah. Showing how many of these people are close to retirement. But what we got, can you look at that? It would be slide number 8. If you take a closer look at that and
get them, Mr. Stromquist.
Yes.
Calling out page numbers, we don't have any of the. You didn't number the documents in there, so we're trying to.
He's talking to David's.
Thank you.
Slide.
Thank you.
My
slide 8, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Proceed, Mr. Okay. Stromquist. And again, I do need you to give your proposal, and
here's
if you've got
proposal.
That in writing, that you can give it to us, so we have that. We'd appreciate that as well.
Mr.
Got
Chair,
a written summary of that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My proposal is just that. Honor what they thought was the original agreement. It's inequitable, the change they're making. They're looking at some of these people are losing 71%, 45, 19, 0. That's a big number. That's too big a number. And so what I would propose is let's do an equitable change. Let's do the same change for everybody. And the only way I could see it doing that is let's at least honor this until 65. At 65, cut her down to 2% and go forward. It would save the pension fund a tremendous amount of money. I'm not an actuary. I can't calculate that. And I think that proposal has a little bit merit for both parties. It's a compromise each way. After 65, they're only getting 2%. But honor the agreement for at least the people that are close to retirement. When you cut a pension right at the end of the pension, that's the most detrimental time. If you've got a life insurance policy, you know what happens when you stop paying life insurance premiums at the end. It's a huge difference. So to cut it right at the end of the most appreciable period, I think, is penal, and that's what's happening here. That's why people are taking an average cut, if you take a look at their documents, of 40%. That is what they showed on their random sample. And the only other document I wanted to show you is that random sample itself. Here it is right here. And I'm sorry, but their random sample is taken from the universe as a whole. It was represented to me as a random sample. And if you ran those numbers down and divided by the number of parties, they're taking a 41% hit. I think that's too much. That's way too much. And that's the issue, is they're due for some sort of cut, some fair cut. Everybody in these pension plans are. Just make it fair, and that's why I'm here.
Mr. Stromquist, for your first time testifying in public speaking, you did a fine job today, sir.
Thank you for that.
You did a fine job. Thank you. And if you have something in writing that you'd like the commission to look at as far as your proposal, we'll take that as well and enter that into the record. Thank you so much, both of you, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And the next party that I have that is on our agenda that is looking to provide some feedback is a Robert Liebig, if I'm pronouncing that correct.
Liebig,
sorry. Well, don't feel bad. I'm 0 for 2 today in last name, sir.
It's the first time someone hasn't put an R in it.
Sir, welcome to the commission, and again, I'm going to give you an opportunity to share some thoughts. Again, we want to observe the rule. If it's something that the commission has already heard, reinforce that and then move on to your new information if you have some things for us to be able to take under consideration here. And I'm just going to ask you to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and you can go ahead and begin with your testimony. And members, Mr. Liebig has provided us with a document that looks like this for his testimony here today as well. So with that, sir, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Liebig. I am married to an employee of Fairview of 21 years at the university and 21 years at Fairview. First, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank Lisa for arranging and in a short period of time to make the time available to come and talk to the committee. We really appreciated that. And also I wanted to thank Representative Kahn. It was nice that she raised a number of the points that I was going to, so I won't go through those, but to have someone that was here in addressing at least what the perception was of the employees of the university and then Fairview was very, very helpful. What I would like to do, and I'll take a very little bit of your time, is, and I may mispronounce her name, but I think there was a memo done by Susan Linwiski to the committee, and I butchered that name too, so fair is fair.
We're even one for one on this side and your side today. So.
And I guess what I would like to address is implicit in the memo that she prepared for the committee was the notion that the employees of Fairview could have reasonably expected that this might happen, or in effect that they should have been in constructive notice this might have happened. And there was a couple of, and I'll read from her memo. As mentioned, there was legislation passed shortly after the spinoff. It is not known why the transaction agreement did not require MSRS to maintain a certain specific level of augmentation so that there was a contractual obligation to maintain this enhanced augmentation. And I think that's a question that Representative Kahn addressed herself. There was two memos, one that I left with you now, which was really handed out to the employees of the University of Minnesota, to be Fairview, back in mid-year in 1996. There was an additional memo that was issued by MSRS, and I have that. It was emailed to me, and I did not have time to print it. But in essence, that was sent by MSRS to the employees and talking about the legislation that was specifically passed that, again, Representative Kahn referred to. And what was clear in my reading of that was that there was an absolute recognition on the part of the legislature that they did and made some extraordinary provisions in order to assure that the merger took place as it related to the employees. I mean, I think other than the economic terms, the augmentation, I think the most significant thing that I saw was that as it related to the rule of 90, they basically said the service that the University of Minnesota employees would be providing as Fairview employees, private sector would count towards the rule of 90. And to me, that was an indication, and again, I'll refer to what Representative Kahn said. This was the linchpin to get the transaction done, the concern about the employees and how they were treated, and the fact that they went to this length clearly demonstrated that it was necessary at the time, and it was a promise that was made in perpetuity. The other point that I think Susan made in her memo to the committee that was, I think, sent February 22nd, and it says, changes to your work pattern or legislative action could affect the final monthly benefit award. The commission could reasonably conclude that the Fairview employees were on notice that the legislation could change their pension benefits. This reference was stated that it was included in benefit calculations that were sent out to employees. I have six different memos that were sent out to Bev from 1997 through November of last year, of 2015. There's never a reference in anything that was sent out that there could be legislative action that potentially could upend what was being proposed. So I guess the point that I would make is that there was great surprise on the part of employees at Fairview. I am not certain as I sit here today that most of the employees may even know that this is happening because the notice came out about 2 weeks ago. And I think you're just now seeing a groundswell of people that are concerned about what happened and how it happened. The only comment I would make, and I guess I will tie into the previous person that came up here and testified, it is definitely for people that were, let's say, in 1996 had spent 10 years or 15 years at the university and now did the transition, their pension benefit is going to be impacted 55% to 60% of what they expected. In many cases, most people looked at this as, I don't want to use the word guarantee, but I think that's the way that they viewed it, that if they stayed till 65, they would draw this benefit. And they used that as a measure of how they would calculate what they were doing aside from this to take care of the retirement. You mentioned the 403B program. Yes, I'm sure most Fairview employees did contribute to it. The question is, did they contribute as much because they were relying on this? I think that's the extent of my testimony. I don't believe that there's any way you can infer that the Fairview employees either had an expectation or should have been constructively informed that this possibly could have occurred.
Mr. Leiberg, thank you for your testimony here today and coming in and sharing your thoughts with the commission.
Thank you very much.
The next person I have on the list is Diane Johnson. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the commission, and if you would go ahead and state your name for the record and, again, share information that you have for the commission to consider that we might not have already heard, and if it's something, just refer to the fact that it's there and then add your thoughts that will help us to better clarify and understand this matter. Again, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Diane Johnson. I'm a 60-year-old woman, worked for University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic between October 1979 and December 31, 1996, when I was transferred to Fairview Health Services as the result of the sale merger of University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic to Fairview Health Services. It was always stated in the HR meetings that the augmentation pension plan for the University of Minnesota hospital employees of 5.5 for under 55 and 7.5 for over 55 was intended as permanent and as presented as such to the University of Minnesota hospital and clinic employees. We received an email from Representative Kahn who stated in agreement that this was true. I have reviewed my documents and see no such clause to end the augmentation at some future date. MSRS has not stated on my annual statements that this augmentation could end in the future. At 60 years old, I do not believe I can make up this loss that I estimate would affect me negatively to approximately 100,000 K over 20 years. I currently participate in the 401k. I have three separate 403bs. I have an IRA and a CD. But Fidelity told me in July of 2014 that until I could tell them how much I would receive on the pension monthly, that I was 35 to 85% short, and that I could not retire until age 70. I feel I have done my part of the agreement by transferring to Fairview Health Services from University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic and staying and leaving the funds in the MSRS. The MSRS strongly advised all transferring University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic employees to leave their funds in the plan and not take a refund. This negotiated pension figures have not changed in so much as the University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic, the University of Minnesota, the State of Minnesota, and the MSRS knew what the augmentation rates were, how much each employee put into the MSRS, the years of service, and age, so the costs of the plan should have been known. It seems unfair, unjust, to say that due to my age, I get to pay the price of the fund's miscalculations and that my retirement can get reduced. As far as Mr. Bergstrom's stating that the figures to the MRS documents have received an increase of, I have only received an increase since 1996 of $210 a month, period. That comes out to be about $10.50 a month, $210 a year. So that is not a huge amount. I will be drastically affected. You know, the documents that I saw as far as Susan, and I won't even pronounce your last name, sorry. I read it four times, my statement that I received in January that actually I received in February. And there is no clause on there that says that I should have known that this was going to happen. absolutely no cost. I had my neighbor come over and read it because I thought I was missing it. I'm like going, I read this four times. Why can't I see this? She says it's there. Where is it? So I just feel that this is very unfair to come to us at this late date and say, sorry, we miscalculated. The university made a lot of money by selling Fairview. They saved a lot of money. They should have gone to the university and asked for more money. The university, it's probably too late to ask the university for more money, but they're the ones that should have paid. They're the ones that decided that it was best to sell the hospital and get rid of the employees. They saved in salary, they saved in benefits, they saved lots of money. And when I transferred over to Fairview, I stayed there because I was 40-some years old. I did not want to go start looking for another job. And I depended upon this. This was the thing that was going to get me to retire at 66 in 4 months. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, thank you for coming up here. We know it's not always easy to come up and tell one's personal story as well as being in a kind of a foreign environment on this, and you as well did a very nice job. And so thank you for your feedback and your input for the commission.
Thank you for your consideration.
Oh, looks like you might have a question if you're able to take questions. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Johnson, your story is very important for us to hear about. It reminds me of, you know, when you get older, you don't take risks anymore in your investments because you don't have time to make it up. And that's what I think you're telling us.
Yeah.
That is your concern right now.
Yeah.
And I want you to know that I certainly think it was an important thing to bring to our attention.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You told me I can't make it up. Also, I'd like to state that the MSRS sent out a letter, a newsletter that basically said the MRS General Employees Retirement Plan is not only the best funded plan in the state, it is one of the best funded plans in the country. This was right on their newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
They said they're 89% viable, but this is, you know, and now they're saying that because of the university employees.
Ms. Johnson, I just want to correct one thing. I don't think that they're saying that it's because of the university employees and the merger that they're having question. It's a component to that they're
right.
looking at on that. So,
right.
Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And the last person that I have who has signed up to testify today is Julie Blyle. Ms. Blyle, welcome to the commission, and you are a veteran of the protocol around here. And so, again, I'm just going to ask for you to provide some additional information that the commission may not have heard today as they consider this matter. And you're also joined by someone else, so I'll ask Mr. Seitz to introduce himself if he's going to be testifying here today at that time as well. But Ms. Blyle, we'll start with you. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and I have with me my boss, Elliot Side, Executive Director for AFSCME Council 5.
Ms. Blyle, your boss, was it bring your boss to work day?
You bet it is. It doesn't happen every day, but.
The pressure you must be under right now.
She brought the weaker of the two of us.
I'd like to go back. To the time of the merger, I served on the Board of Regents during that time, so I have a unique perspective as well as Representative Kahn, and I'd like to reinforce that the testimony that she gave was very accurate recount of what happened during that time. There was a lot of resistance by the employees at the University of Minnesota at the time that the University of Minnesota Hospital Academic Health Center was sold off. And during that time, the last piece of that transaction, and I believe that it may not have gone through if that wouldn't have been a piece of it, was the pension provisions that you're talking about today. And that is what brought the package together. That had to be legislated, not negotiated. AFSCME could not negotiate that. The University of Minnesota could not negotiate it. It had to be done by the legislature. It was done by the legislature. As you've heard, employees have recounted how they've built their lives around the expectations of what that pension would be for their retirement. And I do believe there's a lot of employees that may not be aware of the changes that are being talked about here today. So having said that, it was a promise that was made to those employees, and it's a promise that I believe the legislature should keep. Thank you.
Ms. Blyle, thank you. Mr. Seitz, did you also want to share some thoughts with the commission today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elliot Seid. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words. Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, as Julie has pointed out and as the previous testifiers have said, this was part of an agreement that allowed the merger of Fairview and University Hospital. In fact, and Julie's right, most of the employees are barely aware this is even going on. This started out as a maybe proposal, and frankly, we were both a little surprised it was going to be here today. There needs to be a lot of conversations with the workers affected, I think, before there's any further discussion about this, I would suggest. But I just want you to know, and we'll get this to you after, Mr. Chairman and members, because I have it on my little iPhone here. I had it sent to me. I have the negotiator's report from the union from December 5th of 1997. And in that, we do keep our records over at the office. We try to, anyhow. Couple of things that the commission might want to be aware of, and that is on salary, which obviously affects pensions, that salaries were going to be comparable to the market rate. Employee salaries who are over the top of the UMP salary range were going to have their salaries frozen. Those salary increases would not happen until the salary range caught up to their salary. And, sir, I'm sorry, I don't know how many people were affected by that. I can't tell you that today. It's obviously something we're going to look into to see how many people were like that. They also lost their had their vacation time, sick leave, and so on, transferred over to a PTO-type program, and so they lost a good deal of that. They did maintain their holidays. They did maintain their security. Their health insurance was changed radically from what it had been to something else. There were costs related to that as well. But as part of this negotiator's report, it says pension. AFSCME, the university, and MSRS worked together during the last legislative session to secure an improved MSR pension benefit for those employees going to UMP. It was part of the – you can't negotiate pensions. We're aware that's a prohibitive subject of bargaining. It only could be done here, as the commission well knows, and as we well know. But what was agreed to and negotiated was that the parties would together come to the legislature to do this thing to make it possible to do the merger so that people would understand there would be some protections as they went forward in terms of the defined benefit plan, that there would be some kind of augmentation. That's what we reported on in there, and that came as a result of the negotiations. This merger was a very difficult piece for the union, for the employees, for everyone, but it was to the benefit, we were told, of Fairview. It was the benefit of the people who lived in the area and of healthcare in Minnesota. But there were a lot of changes, sacrifices, and compromises that had to be made by the employees in order to do that. If you look at one of the documents you received from Mr. Bergstrom, you'll see that the largest single group of workers that are affected by this are the those in the 55 to 64, the 55 to 65 group. There are 720, I believe. I don't have it right in front of me. Workers in that group. Those are people, as the last testifier said, who were in the late years, as Senator Johnson had pointed out, and to try to make that up at this point is going to be impossible for them. And the salary levels for these folks and the wage scales right now, not then, but right now, run from $12.63 an hour to $25 and change at Fairview, and from $12 and change to $23 and change at the clinics at this point in time. So, you know, at the very low end to the high end is in the low 50,000s. But most people are somewhere in the middle. And I wish, Chairman Driscoll, I had that for you today. We will get that for you. I've asked my staff to get me the median and the average wages in the unit so you can get an idea of what that is. And we don't even know which exactly of our employees are affected. We don't know. We know there's a number of people who are involved in this, but we have no idea which ones, and we're trying to get to the bottom of that and have meetings with them. I'm sure this is coming as quite a bit of shock to them that they have to deal with this at this point in their career. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, I know you deal with many difficult issues, and I want to make something clear. Over the years, and I think those of you who've been on the Commission and for a while, and those of you newer know, our union has taken a very responsible position about the pension. We've worked with every reform that's been there. We've supported the reforms that have been there at some sacrifice to our members in terms of an increase in employee contributions, increase in employer contributions, which, of course, then take money out of current bargaining to deferred wages. COLA changes. We have taken an incredibly responsible position over the years, and I might add a very conservative position over the years to protect the integrity of the fund. We feel at this point in time this is precipitous. It's being done without sufficient study and research, that we need to talk to a lot of these workers and see what effect this is really going to have on them. And we would ask the Commission, especially in a short session like this where there's going to be so little time to deal with it, to lay this over so we can study it further. And see what makes sense. Maybe the compromise solution that the gentleman suggested earlier, maybe no change, because it's going to be hard for a lot of people here to make up the difference. In any case, there's a lot of moving parts to create the merger, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, and there are a lot of moving parts to this still. And there has not been study of what the impact is on those actual employees, their families, and their futures. And we would ask this to be laid over or to put forth for further study so we could all take a better look at this. We have done everything we can to work with the Commission and all of you on a bipartisan, nonpartisan basis to really produce successful results in our defined benefit pension plans. We ask for a little more time on this as well, sir. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for your time, Ms. Blyle. Thank you for your time as well. That concludes the number of individuals that I had who had asked to testify. We did also, members, receive a written petition by a Paula Shivers, and it is signed by a number of members, and I'm going to ask that to be entered into the official record for this commission meeting as well. I do have just a couple of minutes if there's someone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the commission. I can give folks a couple minutes if there's anyone who feels that they need to step forward at this time. Ma'am, why don't you come down? And we'll give you a couple minutes to share some thoughts that you may have here today as well. So, while she's coming down, Senator Rosen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering what your intent was and if there will be further discussion on this, further testimony, or what's your intent on this?
Senator Rosen, if I could wait until we're done with all the public testimony to kind of share what I see the next step on that is, just so, because I think that'll be a discussion point that will kind of transition from this step to the next step for the commission, if that's okay. Good afternoon, ma'am, and welcome to the commission. And if you would state your name for the record and then share your thoughts. And as I said, we'll give you a couple of minutes to go ahead and do that today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Luann Krantz. I'm one of the employees that was transferred to Fairview. There are a lot of employees that would have liked to have been here, but because we work during the day, they're not able to attend. And some are just finding out the real impact. I'd like to have you think about what Mr. Bergstrom said. He had said that a person that's now 30 would have their benefits doubled twice before they would retire. And he also mentioned the number of employees that are now 35 to 44. And then a little later he mentioned about over 40. If this 30-year-old employee was employed 20 years ago at Fairview, they would have been 10 years old. If they were 35, they would have been 15 years old. I think maybe some numbers need to be relooked at, because I know it's complicated calculations, but those numbers don't add up. And I'd like to reiterate what others have said, that all parties knew how many employees there were, their ages, how much they had contributed. Much due diligence was done at the time. So the board, everyone should have known how much this would cost over the years. And I noticed on your stationery that it says your foundation for retirement. I do participate in 3403Bs and IRAs, and I would like to keep MSRA as a foundation in my retirement. There's not time to make it up, so I'd like you to consider not passing this proposed legislation.
Thank you for your time. Mr. Bergstrom, I'm going to give you a chance because there were some things that were raised here to maybe come back and to share some things to kind of bring this back into perspective from what you had started with and kind of give you the last word on the matter this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things. So the discussion that we just had, I think the youngest employee is about 39, which means they were 19 at the time, gives us about 20 years ago. So I believe the numbers are correct. You know, we just put it in range groups rather than detailing it. I'd just like to follow up, not even specific comments, but just a couple of general comments. First, I want to stress that in 1996, MSRS stepped up, and we protected Rule of 90 rights. We immediately vested employees, and we set up a benefit structure. I think the legislative intent is quite clear. It was to, you know, benefits commensurate with the contributions they made. I think we've more than done that. I also want to make clear it wasn't our goal, it wasn't our charge to do this all on our own. The idea would be that the MSRS benefit when added to the 401k and the 4013. So there's been a lot of discussion here about, and I get their perspective because, you know, they had that perspective, but no one has talked about how much they have in those accounts and what that is worth on a monthly benefit and how much they contributed. There is no doubt that these are reductions in benefits, and we don't take that lightly. Our board thinks about it. We look at it. And I want to remind everybody, in 2010, effective 2012, we lowered the augmentation for everybody in our plan from, you know, from the 3 and 5 down to 2% prospectively. We did notify the employees. I will tell you it was only 3 or 4 weeks ago. But we did want to let them know this was happening, so it's not like, I don't want anybody left with the impression that they don't know about this. Could we have given a little more notice? Sure. But in the process and with everything going on, you know, but in fairness to them, we did tell them. Again, if we continue the doubling of these benefits, it's just not appropriate. So whether it generates benefit amounts that far exceeded what everybody thought. I will take the blame because if I had done the math back then, I probably could have figured it out. But at the time, most of the focus was on the people who were 2 years from retirement. It was such an emotional time. You put together a package and you deal with it. We're in a different time. We're not 107% anymore. We're in the 84%. Things have changed. I think MSRS, I want to make it clear, MSRS stepped up. And had they not, it would have been a different story for most of these people's retirement, and not in a positive way. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just end my points.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. One other comment that I'll make that the commission has been made aware of just generally with pensions as we look at all of these is the mortality tables have said folks are living healthier, happier, and longer, and that's, I'm sure, is a part of the merger that we're talking about today because of healthcare and different kinds of things. So there's sometimes 20 years ago we didn't know variables that we were looking at today, and so we have to always keep an eye looking forward to make sure that everyone who's looking at a pension would be able to be have a reasonable expectation that benefit or some assimilation of that benefit is going to be able to be there to be able to help them. So thank you, Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Members, this is the very first time that this has been before us. And Senator Rosen, you had a question, but it looks like Representative Cresha may have another question, but I'll get to him. Go ahead, Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, I'm just curious about the retention rate of the employees over that 20-year span. Did 80% of the employees stick through this? I mean, what has been the retention rate of those?
Mr. Chair, I really don't know that. Sure. They get the augmentation whether they stayed and left. Fairview might be able to provide that, but it's, you know, so even if an employee is no longer with Fairview, they're still getting this enhanced augmentation. So I don't know if I even can do that.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, if you could just again point out if there was a salary change going from the U to Fairview, if the increase in salary from that change. Did they receive a salary increase?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Along with their...
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, if I understood the testimony right, I think some of them were frozen back then. So I want to make it clear, I was involved in a small piece of this. I was not involved in the negotiation of salary or health care benefits or overtime. I was over in the corner working on the pension piece because that was my charge. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what their salaries did. When we look, we still get some payrolls, and I am not saying that everybody here, you know, would have been better had they, or would have been worse had they stayed in MSRS. There are cases where people's high fives are higher, but I don't know the impact of salaries back then because it's, I don't know what happened.
Thank you.
Senator Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, have you listened to the recording, the historical record of the meetings that the Pension Commission had to learn the intent, you know, to clear up any of misunderstandings?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I haven't gone back and listened to the recording. I just took that legislative intent out of the statute.
Well, members, this is obviously the first time that we've heard it. It's a new item, a newer item before the commission. What my thoughts and recommendations would be is to let Mr. Bergstrom continue to work with this issue and the interested parties to see if there's a workable solution to this and to continue to work with the legislative staff in the way of Ms. Lynchewski and Ms. Barth to continue to look at this issue. I want good public policy, and so I think that we need to continue to move forward and ask some more questions and maybe bring this back to the commission at some point in the future once we've had a chance to digest this information. So, Senator Rosen, that's my intent right now is to certainly not take action on it, but to continue to dig in and to collect more information for the benefit of the commission so we can make a good public policy decision on how to handle this as we've done with other things in the past as well. Commission doesn't always act on things when it comes to them on the very first time through on things. And so I think it warrants some more discussion and work at a staff level. So members, that brings us to our next item today, which is going to be on our agenda, the Eden Prairie Volunteer Fire Relief Association. With that, Representative Loon and the president of the Eden Prairie Fire Relief Association, Mr. Aaron Casper, are going to be making a presentation to the commission about some things that are happening to Eden Prairie and some things that we may have some staff input on that may be coming about as a result of this work to help some of our other relief associations who may be having some things that Eden Prairie was kind enough to be able to bring forward for consideration. Representative Loon, welcome to the commission. Mr. Casper, welcome to the commission. We'll start with Representative Loon, and if you will go ahead and state your name for the record and position this for us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Pension Commission. I am Jennifer Loon, State Representative for Eden Prairie's District 48B. And I am very pleased to be joined by Aaron Casper, who is president of the Eden Prairie Firefighters Relief Association. And I will speak just very briefly and let you hear from Mr. Casper, who is the expert on these issues. But I have had a chance in the past to meet with Mr. Casper about the issue that we're bringing before the Pension Commission today. And I just, of course, need to say that Eden Prairie's firefighters are tremendous community servants. They are volunteer-paid on call. And so the pension benefits that are offered to really entice people to be part of that that team and that very vital public service is an important part of how they attract and keep people in our service. So I think that the issues that they're bringing forward would help them continue to be something that would be attractive for people to want to volunteer for and to be service to the Eden Prairie community. There are two components to the proposal today. Section 1 has to do with amending the bylaws of the Eden Prairie Firefighters Relief Association to increase the current lump sum pension payout amount. Currently, it's capped at $10,000, and they would like the option of having that lifted to up to $15,000. As you know, we do have a defined benefit plan for our firefighters, and but they also offer the lump sum option. But with the current cap, it's not an option that's very attractive to many of those firefighters, and it is something that many have expressed an interest in. So I would hope that the commission would look favorably upon that. The other section has to do with adopting a shorter vesting period for a firefighter who would return to service after receiving a pension. And I'll let Mr. Castor speak to how many individuals may be in that situation. But as you know, right now we have a 10-year vesting period, which must be 10 years complete to receive a pension. And to attract people who may already have received that pension, who have done their full 10 years of service, to come back in, they are currently are having to wait 10 more years for that pension. And we would like to allow that vesting period to be shorter. Perhaps no less than 3 years, to allow that to be, again, something that would be more attractive to keeping those good firefighters maybe coming back to service if we need them. So with that, I will turn it over to the expert, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today.
Thank you, Representative Loon. President Casper, if you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony for the commission, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron Casper, the president of the Eden Prairie Fire Relief Association. And members of the commission, thank you for having me here today, and thank you, Representative Loon. So really, what you have before you today are two provisions that we're really essentially asking for the legislature to give the Relief Association and its membership the opportunity to have a conversation with our city council to address both of these topics, the first of which is the increasing of the lump sum. We're currently at the statutory cap of $10,000 per year of service, and we'd like that the ability to discuss this with the City Council of Eden Prairie to potentially raise that up to a maximum of $15,000. So it could be anywhere between that range. And a lot of that actuarial calculation will come in at that point in time. We can't have that conversation today because we're already at the cap. The reason for that, as Representative Loon mentioned, the vast majority of our membership has traditionally taken the defined benefit. As a board member and the president of our Relief Association, we feel it would be in our best interest and the interest of the fund to actually close that gap and be able to create more of an incentive for our members to actually consider that lump sum portion. Because right now, the difference is so large that folks gravitate to where they would probably have the best value, and that is in our defined benefit. So we're just trying to narrow that gap, and then actuarially we determine what that lump sum would be in the future. Our second provision is a critical one from a retention perspective. Right now, we have folks that hit 10 years of service and age 50, and this is a voluntary job, which probably right now at a minimum is we're looking at about 50 hours a month per firefighter with training and their duty crew hours. So when they attain age 50, what's happening is we're losing that 10 years of experience, because the only way that those folks can go ahead and draw a pension, either a lump sum or a monthly benefit, is to actually separate service and then be eligible to receive their payment. Well, they're not coming back. So what we would like to do is we'd like to have the option to discuss with our city council of reducing that secondary vesting period to no less than 3 years. So if we're able to get an additional 2, 3, maybe 5 at the most out of our experienced firefighters, so that as we're bringing up new people that are coming in, which we're having a very difficult time of doing, I think there's a tremendous value in that. We've had that discussion with the City Council. We've had that discussion with our actuary. It's a very nominal increase in our total aggregate liability. Actuaries go on experience. We don't have any experience in this, but we really feel that what we're asking the legislature to do is really provide us with some options to try to fill those gaps in terms of the attraction and the retention.
Mr. Casper, thank you for your testimony. One of the things that I've learned, having been involved in local government, and I'm sure Eden Prairie experiences the same thing as the cities in my community do, and that's finding daytime coverage in a paper service structure for delivering fire safety matters.
Mm-hmm.
Folks are mobile. They aren't working necessarily in the same businesses in the community that they live and serve on the department. They may be called all the way from Minnetonka mm-hmm. from their job to come down. And when you have folks who retire after receiving their benefits and then agree to come back in what I'll call an emeritus type status, to vest in that, needing another 10 years seems a little bit punitive and perhaps tying your hands and being able to get folks. And so, again, this is after one has already received a pension, who has considered to come back and if you will, re-enlist to service to the community, would have a shorter vesting period to receive a supplemental. Am I stating that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Casper, I know Eden Prairie comes up with a lot of great ideas, but is this something that a lot of other fire departments are thinking about, too, or relief associations?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, yeah. I would say that that's not out of the question, certainly for the lump sum, I believe. So there's really only a handful of metro departments that are a combination defined benefit, defined contribution, of which Eden Prairie is one. I do know that there are a couple other departments that would be interested in seeing that cap increased as well, so that they too can just in fact have the discussion at the city council level and the membership level. So I would not disagree with that.
Senator Saxhog, you had the same question I had asked when this was brought forward. So the two of us are thinking alike. I don't know if that's good or bad, but we're thinking alike. Members, additional questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Casper, is there no other option in place of reducing the vesting for a returning firefighter after he or she is retired?
Casper.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator or Representative Erickson, just to make sure I understand the question correctly, are you asking me if there's any other options available other than the three-year vest?
Correct.
Okay, so there are other options available. Right now, we have as it stands now legislatively, we would have a 10-year vest if anyone came back. So after the 60-day break in service, the discussion for us is really it revolves around safety and experience, and obviously service to our public. So. From our perspective, this is really this profession, in my opinion, I'll say, is really a young person's game. So what we want to do is we want to try, the goal of this is to try to, what can we find that would reasonably incent someone to come back after they've just dedicated, at a minimum, 10 years of voluntary service to their community, having served a mandatory 60-day break / vacation, right, so not having to do that for 60 days, what would be reasonable? From our perspective, Eden Prairie is well-positioned. As of our last actuarial evaluation, we were 93% funded as of 1/1/2015. We have to do evaluation every 2 years. So we can afford it. And we really want to try to keep that experience. Anecdotally, we just don't have people come back. It just doesn't happen. So we felt with the three-year vest, it was reasonable. We're looking at a 36-month minimum requirement to come back to actually potentially earn a lump sum payment only going forward. If, in fact, they did stay longer, they would still only be eligible for a lump sum in whatever the year of service would be. So are there other options? Yes. We felt the three-year was a minimum.
Members, my understanding is that Eden Prairie has special legislation that covers them in their fire relief compared to others that are across the state. Am I correct in that assumption? In that, Ms. Barr?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. That's special legislation, I believe, from 1995 that allowed Eden Prairie to kind of set their own unique vesting period compared to other relief associations right. in the state.
Yeah, others have a 20-year vesting, and Eden Prairie has special legislation for a 10-year on that. And that's why I was thinking, okay, so how do we work? And that's how I discovered that they had a 10-year vest instead of the other. Representative Erickson, follow-up
question. So, Mr. Chair, this would not be setting a precedent?
This would not be setting a precedent. Well, two different things. We have the $10,000 to $15,000. The commission is going to be asked to consider doing that statewide with that augmentation, if you will, or that change. The second is this three-year provision is Eden Prairie specific, which would be inside of the special legislation for Eden Prairie that was passed back in the mid-90s, according to what Ms. Barth said. That's my understanding.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps.
Representative, now Senator Hayden. How's that?
Yeah, how about that? That's good. That's good stuff. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then that starts to beg the question of if they had something that in 95 that changed, and I don't know what that is. Maybe I should ask, but it's probably because of the size of the growing community, I would think. Now we want something moving forward. I guess what I would ask, Representative Loon and your testifier, is there another way that we should look at it? Is the community growing to the extent that maybe it needs to look at a different way in which the fire department operates? And I don't know enough about this, so it's really not a loaded question, but if maybe now your community is growing to the point that it needs to look at a full-time fire department or something different as opposed to the model that you have today. And if that's offline, please let me know, but I'm trying to follow that through.
Which one of you gets to answer that question?
I'm going to defer, Mr. Chair, to President Casper on that issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, so I'm going to take a stab at this. There's a couple things that I'm hearing in your statement and question. From our perspective, and I want to be careful not to speak for the City Council and certainly for Fire Chief Espenson, but our model has really worked for our community thus far. We have four stations. Legislated locally to go up to a 95 full-time fire or paid-on-call volunteer firefighters. We're currently at a staffing level of 88. We've never reached the 95. So what that means is that there's more pressure on the folks that are there. Okay, there is about, don't quote me on the number here, but in my conversations with Fire Chief Espenson, there's about an $800,000 to $1 million additional cost for the city to potentially transition to a full-time department. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm on a separate side of the table. I don't think that's a goal at this point. The Relief Association operates independently of the city and the City Council. So what we're trying to do, and we work collaboratively with the city, we have for many decades. So what we're trying to do is find a legislative fix that will allow us at the local level to have the conversation to really see what would be the best fit for our firefighters and the city in meeting those ongoing emergency needs. So I think I've probably already gone out far enough on the full-time discussion, so I'm going to retreat back on that.
Well, thank you. I think that's helpful. I'm just trying to figure out where does this thank you, Ms. Chair, where this goes. I mean, if you where what's the right size and the right fit? I don't know enough about all of the departments and the growth of other communities that are like yours, but it just seems to me that if there's a precedent that was set in 95, now we're looking for another one. What stops you from 3 years or 4 years from now to say that, you know, we need a little more relief, or what stops other communities that are in similar situations to come in and want us to change? So Mr. Chair, I'll stop there because I don't know enough about it, but I think that's my instincts as we start to think about it.
Senator Hayden, I think there's two things that you have to look at. Number one, they have an immediate need, and then it's a public policy statement for the City Council in Eden Prairie to determine what's the best method of delivering those services for their folks. So I think they're looking at two different attacks here, if you will, on that. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and whoever wishes to speak. So the three-year term, then, is that available to any volunteer fire department then? And the reason I ask is because I have three cities, Blaine, Spring Lake Park, and Moundsview, who we have a volunteer fire department and have always looked at it as a very, very good deal for the residents of our communities. And they are also facing the issue of recruitment. So I wanted to know if they could do that, something like this.
Senator Johnson, I think that question is probably better directed toward Rachel Barth, because she's the staff person who did the research on this and can give us some background.
Thank you.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Johnson. So, yes, Eden Prairie is very unique in that they have full vesting at 10 years, which is unlike any other of the lump sum pension plans in Minnesota. And they don't have partial vesting. So 5 years gets you nothing. You have to have the exact 10 years. And Eden Prairie is also unique in that because they are a combined relief association of a monthly benefit and a lump sum, they are required to have an actuary determine their annual accrued liability for every year. And every relief association is also required to do that. But for Eden Prairie, their actuary can build in this additional liability of allowing this three-year full vesting for returned firefighters, whereas the other lump sums in the state have to use a table based in statute that is essentially a present value table. And it causes an unfunded liability when, because this table is based on the 20-year full vesting, for any sort of amount of time that's less than 20 years, it would cause an unfunded liability. And so it's hard for those other lump sum plans to build in that unfunded liability, and they'd have to go to their municipality to ask for additional funding. And I don't know if Ms. Hennessy Allen has anything else to add to that point. Okay. Is that who I discussed with? No.
And
I apologize.
She also was bring your boss to work day because the state auditor is sitting next to her as well.
Yeah.
Because we spoke with the state auditor about making that provision statewide, and that was the main concern, was how these other lump sum plans would be able to determine their liabilities every year. And there's actually an example on page 3 of my memo that gives you kind of what it would be for any of the other lump sum service plans at the very bottom, right before number 3, the indented portion. It can kind of show you how that unfunded liability would show up if they continued to use the table, because most lump sum pensions plans do not have the ability to use an actuary. So that's kind of where the trouble comes.
Senator Johnson, follow up.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair and staff.
Yeah.
What I really want to know is, could Spring Lake Park, SBM, I should say, could they do, they have a 20-year, I believe, and could they then say a three-year term, they could get a lump sum money if they came back after a 60-day?
Ms. Barr.
I'm actually going to pass it over to Ms. Hennessy Allen because she knows the more specifics about each relief association. I don't know specifically if that would, how that would work, and if they're a combined, I'm sorry.
Welcome. Go ahead and state your name, if you would, for the record, and then if you want to proceed to answer Senator Johnson's questions. Welcome.
Thank you. Rose Hennessy Allen with the Office of the State Auditor. Mr. Chair, Senator, the Spring Lake Park Fire Relief Association actually joined the statewide plan that's administered by PARA on, I believe, January 1st of this year. So the return to service provision in 424A is no longer available to them. Mm-hmm.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and then would any other volunteer fire department be able to use a three-year term for an additional recruitment tool?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as this proposal is written, no. This change is Eden Prairie only.
Okay.
Let it be.
We've got other folks that are on the list here as well, Senator Pappas. We're good at Senator Johnson. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Eden Prairie is going to pay for this?
Mr. Casper.
We don't pay any of this.
My assumption is no, but let's verify, shall we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's correct. This would be an agreement with the Firefighters Relief Association and the City Council based on actuarial evaluation to make any type of change, correct?
So as long as they don't come back and ask us to bail them out, I don't see what the issue is.
I think this is what we typically call enabling legislation. Representative Anderson, and then Senator Pappas right after her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hennessy Allen, can you tell me how many people, this is kind of a little separate issue, but since you're here, I just wanted to ask this question. How many people do you have as part of the auditor staff that work on just this volunteer relief association?
Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently we have three pension analysts who are full-time employees, myself, and then we have a student intern who's a part-time employee.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rose Hennessy, Allen, what percentage of your budget, of the entire state auditor's budget, is taken out of this? If you can kind of give me that information, that'd be helpful.
Otto, Otto, welcome to the commission. It sounds like you maybe have more information to Representative Anderson's question, so if you want to go ahead and identify yourself and then answer the question, welcome.
Mr. Chair, Rebecca Otto, State Auditor. As you probably are aware, we're currently in litigation. We filed a complaint and with the courts, and Representative Anderson on the committee she's on has been very engaged, and it's not appropriate for us at this committee hearing regarding pension legislation to discuss anything about the office.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Auditor, my question to you is what part of your budget is consumed by the Volunteer Fire Relief Association, your responsibilities for that?
When we provide the, Mr.
Auditor
Chair,
Otto.
The budget document we provide the committee has that information, so I'm sure the non-fiscal, nonpartisan fiscal staff can provide that to you. I don't have that at the top of my head at the moment.
Now, Ms.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Auditor, if you could provide that information and email it to me, I'm sure other members of the committee would find that helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, when we talked about possibly making this lump sum increase from 10 to 15,000 a statewide option, I believe you referred to that. We were not including the vesting.
Right. That is correct.
I just wanted to clarify that.
That's two separate things.
The two separate things.
Eden Prairie has the separate 10-year vest, mm-hmm. wants that 3-year, if you will, mm-hmm. re-enlistment period, where everybody else has the 20-year mm-hmm. to be able to vest. But we've also have determined that there are other departments that are bumping up against that 10 to 15,000
right.
and would like that. And the suggestion is that that portion could go statewide. The other part is specifically for Eden Prairie.
But then I think my question would be, you know, obviously they're asking for it, others are not. But wouldn't you think that other volunteer fire departments were also having similar problems in recruitment and retention? So what is unique about Eden Prairie that I missed something, I think, in the vesting conversation?
One of the things that I might want to do, Senator Pappas, is refer back to Ms. Barth on that, because that is, again, part of the question that I asked is, if we're going to do this, let's have good public policy for everyone. And staff was able to provide, through their research, an answer to my question. I'd just like to have them share that with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas. So, again, Eden Prairie is unique in that they are able to employ an actuary to do
their life.
Yes, and that's the problem with the other lump sum plans. They also have retention and recruitment problems, but for them, this sort of solution that works for Eden Prairie would actually cause more harm to them in the sense of calculating their liability every year.
All right, thank you. And you did say that. I apologize.
No. Other member questions for Representative Loon or the testifier today on the matter before? Is there anyone in the public who would like to testify? Oh, Mr. Rice, I forgot you are already on the list. Sir, come down and share your thoughts as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice, and I'm here this afternoon testifying on behalf of the Maplewood Fire Relief Association. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, and as Ms. Barth mentioned in her memo, Maplewood is one of those funds that is at the 10,000 level. And in fact, just Sunday at their annual meeting, there was some talk about, you know, is there legislation that would raise the cap? And when I saw this on Monday, I contacted you and talked to Ms. Lincheski as well. And they would be interested in doing it. Just a quick way of background, in 2008, this was the last time the cap was raised, and I worked on that at that time with a group of members, and this cap had kind of periodically been revisited about every 2 or 3 years at the legislature, but in 2008, the cap got set, and then as we all know, the Great Recession hit, markets dropped, and it's really been the last 8 years for some of these funds to finally catch up. And a number of funds are looking at increasing it. I could tell the committee there's probably about 6 that would be on the horizon. So we thank Representative Loon and our colleagues at Eden Prairie for bringing this legislation forward. We do think, as a matter of policy, it would be good for the commission to consider, I think it's the 1A amendment, that would apply just for the lump sum plan, which is all maple wood is a lump sum plan. It has a different vesting schedule. Eden Prairie is unique in parts of their plan and their vesting schedule, but we do think you, in terms of legislative economy, you could save yourself a lot of bills coming forward either later this year or next year, where people will start to ask to raise the cap. And in fact, one of the beauties of this legislation, I've been before the Pension Commission since 1982. Back then, there's 700 some relief associations. There weren't quite 700 bills every year, but there were a lot. And some of the work you've done on vesting the caps has made a much more uniform relief association system throughout the state, where members then, the financing has to be in place, they have to meet objective criteria, there has to be a certain minimum amount of financing every year in order to raise the cap. If they can do that, the members vote on it, city councils confirm it or not. If they don't, the members are at risk and the city's only committing to what they agree to do. I think that was Representative Thiessen's question. Once there's a commitment by the city, they have to meet that if the financing circumstances change. The state does have a formula that provides the bulk of the money of this through the Fire State Aid Program, but that program's been in existence for, it's actually the first tax the state ever imposed in the 1870s on a statewide basis, and dedicated to firefighting. And I think there's never been any dispute about where that money goes or how it's collected. It's fair, it's done part on population, part on valuation. These formulas that are here, we're really just asking by the 1A amendment, and of course with permission of Representative Loon on her bill, to extend that ladder up to $15,000 per year of service. And I might just add, it's probably the best buy that Minnesota gets in fire protection. Frequently we'll talk about where Minnesota rates and taxes or expenditures, but the last I looked, Minnesota ranks 46th out of 50th in expenditures per capita for fire service, and that's largely because you have about 19,000 Minnesotans who volunteer, are volunteer firefighters, and it's by and far the best deal I think you get out of government. If anything, you ought to spend more on these programs, and this isn't spending more, it's just allowing the funds that have the money to set up a greater remuneration for the people who do this work. And when you compare it for, I think you were saying it's about probably at least 50 hours a month, 600 hours a year is pretty typical of these relief associations. And so $10,000 per year of service is very modest compensation for all the training that these people have to do and the risks that they take and the services they provide. So if I get to conclude, Mr. Chairman, I guess our plea from Maple would be that the commission consider the 1A amendment for the lump sum plans.
Thank you, Mr. Rice, and that's kind of consistent with some of the questions and the feedback that has been discussed here today as well. Is there anyone else who needs to testify in the matter that's before the commission? Seeing none, members of the commission, your discussion and thoughts. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, just on the idea of going statewide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I always think that, you know, some of our pension principals talk about consistency mm-hmm. between pension plans, and especially if it's going to be a local decision, they can decide if they feel like they can afford it or not, and it doesn't really impact us. Other than that, we have a general, I think we should follow our principles that encourage pension funds to have conformity.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. I'm going to ask staff procedurally here. We've received the A1 amendment that Mr. Rice has referred to, and we were going to amend this just to make sure that we get this process right, if it is, in fact, the wishes and intentions of the commission to proceed as such on that. So, Ms. Lincheski, if you could provide some procedural oversight for us on this.
Rachel, I'm going to turn it over.
Ms. Barr.
She's been working on this.
Mr. Chair, you mean what the amendment says?
No, not what the amendment says. If we were to take this, because we were putting together some things that we're including in the potential omnibus bill for this session, we should be adopting this A1 amendment, which would include the $15,000 and the three-year that was discussed for Eden Prairie?
Correct, yes. So the vesting would be made statewide because it's amending the original bill, which initially just had it be a special legislation. And yes, it also then includes the special legislation for the vesting period. And so I believe that would replace, this is what we have to pass to put into the omnibus. Well, I don't.
We could. This is just a blind thing. So just by adopting this movement, the motion would be to include this amendment in the omnibus.
Okay. So I guess since it's delete all, then yes, you would just move this amendment.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we were looking at that. Members, is there any other discussion? Again, the amendment, which is a delete all, moves the $10,000 cap annual or $10,000 cap to 15 statewide, including Eden Prairie, who originally brought the idea. And then there's the specific fix, if you will, or legislation with inside the special legislation that allowed Eden Prairie to have kind of an exception that would allow for that 3-year additional reenlist, if you will. Senator Pappas?
So, Mr. Chairman, then I would move that the 1A amendment to document LCPR 16025 be recommended to be included in the omnibus pension bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you for your time. Thank you, Representative Loon.
Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
I don't think that passed because we only had 2 votes on the House.
I will defer to... Lisa, I'm going to ask you on that. Is this something that, because we're looking at including it, we would only need a majority of the members present, or is it that we would need to have a majority of both?
Speak of ladder.
Okay. Well, then, yeah. No, I'm not sure. Sure, where they left either. So what we'll do.
Renew the motion later, maybe.
And that's exactly what I'm going to look at doing, Representative Thiessen, when that happens. And maybe we needed a restroom break or something because we've been at this for a couple of hours, and that's where they went. I'm not sure. So, Representative Luna, looks like you and the President Casper are on. Yeah, looks like you're on the track you want. Apparently, we just got some procedural matters that we need to resolve here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commission members. Yes, I was hearing positive feedback around the table through your questions, so I just want to thank the Commission for their consideration. And I think this would be something that would, you know, with the amendment, help firefighter associations statewide, but also specifically the situation we have in Eden Prairie. So I thank you.
Thank you. Item number 4, it says comments by the chair on the various funding packages that we have received and had a chance to visit about before. I've had some members come to me with some questions and concerns about that, and some were shared with us by different interest groups that were on here, and we're still in the process of pulling information together about how might it affect our school districts, how might it affect MSRS and our different agencies and things. And my comments are going to be that I would like to continue to do some research on this and have the plans who came forward, they did a great job. They had, you know, 9 to 12 months to put that information together, to visit with their constituency groups and their boards on that. And we have staff that has replaced some veterans that we've had, and they're doing an outstanding job. And I'd like to give them the opportunity to do some review and evaluation and share some comments along the way on this process for us as well, when they get a chance to kind of take apart and look at that and share some ideas. Again, we want good public policy. And we're still pending some additional information coming in. So it is my hope and wishes that the Commission will take a marked approach to this so that we can get the best public policy and have the best information. Not that the plans have offered something that's not plausible. It is an idea. We also employ people to help provide staff support or support from staff to the Commission to be able to kind of vet those different things that come forward to us as well as we're going through that due diligence process. So those are my thoughts, and I would open it up to Commission members for their thoughts and comments on that as well. We on the right track, do you think, on that? Senator Rosen and then Senator Pappas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the thoughtfulness on this approach. I think it is something that we have to make sure that we do it correctly, and so I appreciate more time to look at it.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it is a big jump to make in 1 year, even though as we set things in place. And so I was actually thinking about a proposal of maybe looking at making the increase in the out years and doing a much smaller phase in, like a quarter or 0.5% a year. But I think that given that it is a short session, money is tight, everyone has lots of priorities.
they have a huge surplus.
Well, actually, if we put... We don't. We don't have such a huge surplus. It's been reported at $1.9 billion, but $700 of that is going into the reserve. And then of the rest, 65% is one-time money. So, I mean, I've been around here a long time, and I don't want us to make mistakes we've made in the past where we thought we had a lot of money and we cut taxes and we increased spending, and all of a sudden we're in deficit and deficit and deficit. So I do think we have to be very careful how we're spending money. I think it's very important. The vitality of the funds is extremely important. We don't want to put that at risk, and I really want to applaud the fund directors for being very responsible and coming forward with sustainability plans as they've done in the past. But I think we do have to take a very careful look at this. Thank you.
Other thoughts? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to relate to you and staff that the school districts are very, very concerned about it. I've had discussions with my school districts and others, so I think that's a good idea to do some.
And again, we know we need to do something. We're not at crisis stage right now, thankfully, because of the due diligence of this commission, right. Our plans, the employees, the work that we have. But I want to make good public policy statements and decisions, and not to necessarily dredge up old wounds, but boy, that first item that we heard from folks, we thought one thing at that time, and then we're dealing with it again. I just want us to continue to be on a good track where there's predictability and things for folks. And so those are my rationale.
My comment, too, is to say that, you know, the information that was brought out in our last meeting by the funds was very, very helpful for me to see it in writing, something that I can look at and think about and refer to other people about it. So I thank the funds people.
Right. Well, then what we'll do is we'll continue to have staff look at this, and then we'll revisit if there's information that they have later on this session to be able to relate to us. And it might, as well as Senator Pappas pointed, with a short session, we may end up just continuing that due diligence process and address it in the 2017 cycle if that seems to be the appropriate thing for us to be able to do. So with that, then let's move on to number five, and I think we're going to be running into the same type of situation on this one. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a five-minute recess here to see if I can't find out where some of our other folks would be to be able to help us to... Oh, sorry. We are still good. I want to keep things moving. Thank you. Yes, I see it's dash M2, so M means motion. It does. That's where we'll just need the majority of those at the commission to move forward. Ms. Lincheski, I'm going to ask you to talk about the Appleton and White Bear Lake, but I do believe that the I'll let you go ahead and talk about the changes that we're looking at for those relief associations as well as White Bear. Ms. Lincheski.
This is the same issue or concern that we brought forward a couple meetings ago, and that was with respect to several other firefighter relief associations under the statute, and that's Minnesota Statutes 356.215, Subdivision 18. The firefighter associations are required to come, and really can be on the recommendation of their actuary, come to the Pension Commission for approval of actuarial assumption changes. So we have presented in the materials the recommendation from the actuary, which in this case is Gabriel Roeder Smith, to the Commission to approve the assumptions. And they've set out the specific assumptions that they would like to apply immediately or right away. And then they also are noting in the letter, and this is part of the motion, that when the experience study that's being conducted on the public employees' police and fire retirement fund is completed, and then assumptions are changed in accordance with that experience study, that the assumptions for the actuarial assumptions for Appleton and for the other city, which is Wiper Lake. So sorry. That those assumptions will change automatically in accordance with how they are changed for the police and fire fund at PARA.
So that's the motion in front of you, and we have two of them, 5A and 5B. One is for Appleton, as mentioned. The other is for White Bear Lake.
Members, discussion on the motions before the commission. Again, as Ms. Lincheski pointed out, this needed to be reviewed, and that does need commission approval according to the process.
Mr. Chairman, I would move then the, I think it's called the M2, motion M2.
And you probably can
and M3.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably do them both in the same motion.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Adkins is here to talk about our next item, which is a request that he and Representative Thiessen had put forward and asked if we could have a hearing on it, and I do like to accommodate members' requests. And so for Representative Thiessen and Representative Adkins, I'm going to ask the two of you to go ahead, Mr. Rice and Mr. Representative Adkins, excuse me, to go ahead and
soon
share.
To be Mr., though.
I read that somewhere. to overview this. Members, I also would like to let you know that if we can, we've got 50 minutes left of our scheduled time. If you can hang in there when we're done with this, the other stuff is pretty procedural, and then I'll give you tomorrow off, and we don't have to carry over things on the agenda. So I hate to say this, but Mr. Rice and Mr. Representative Adkins, you kind of do hold our destiny in your hands. So brevity is always important on these matters, as you well know, Mr. Chair. With that, Representative Adkins, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I also came to say thank you because you were kind enough 3 years ago in 2013 to help with a bill that shored up what originally brought this issue to our attention with regard to the police and firefighters. There is a group of police and firefighters, though, that have kind of fallen through the cracks. And on behalf of myself and Senator Hayden, who's the Senate author of this legislation, I wanted to acknowledge his assistance as well. There's a group of 83 police and firefighters and 187 widows of police and firefighters that for various reasons, were left behind. And when it comes to firefighters and police officers, they always talk about leave nobody behind. And we don't want to leave these folks behind. There's a funding stream that is available to make things right for these 83 firefighters and police officers and 187 widows. I know that the materials, and I appreciate, by the way, the staff did a great job in terms of outlining what the issues are. They acknowledge that there's the existing funding stream that was approved by this body in 2013. If we extend that for one more year, we can be right with these 83 firefighters and police officers and 187 widows. It does cost a little bit of money, but it doesn't make anybody rich, folks. If you look at the numbers, we're not talking about paying out pensions that are $50 or $70 or $100,000. You're talking $2,000 a month for a widow. When you think about the sacrifice that these firefighters and officers have made and that their families have made along with them, it only seems fair and it seems right, and we've got a funding stream that allows us to do that. And with that, I'd appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Adkins, thank you. What I'm going to do, because he is the co-author on this, or I should say the Senate author and a member of this commission, I'm going to give Senator Hayden an opportunity to share any thoughts that he has at this point in the setup as well. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to ensure that we get through this day timely and we don't have to come back tomorrow, I'm going to defer to Mr. Rice to go through the bill and let the commission listen to the testimony.
Well, the old razzle-dazzle. Where's the football? Hey, Mr. Rice,
thank
apparently
you,
it's in your hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Police Fraternal Association. That is a group of approximately 700 retirees that receive their pensions from PRA, Police and Fire, as well as a number of widows as well. That group is predominantly a group from the Minneapolis Police Relief Association that consolidated with PRA at the end of 2011, but it has expanded by about 100 members. And this is a cohort of individuals. PERA, as a result of legislation in 2014, I believe that Senator Hayden and Representative Adkins had asked for a comprehensive study of this group of people, and there's a document that was submitted to the LCPR last January 15th that was very comprehensive and detailed this issue. And there's a lot of history with this. At one point in time, there were 45 paid firefighter and police relief associations in the state spread throughout the state. Eventually, they all consolidated through either a series of individual acts of the legislature or a more comprehensive law that was adopted in 1987 that allowed for a voluntary process that allowed members to make decisions, city to make decisions. Along the way, there were a number of events that included first having these groups become constituent parts of PERA, and many were eventually folded into PERA. But at the end of the day, I think Representative Atkins said it best. Taking all of this history, there's a group of members whose pensions are, let's say they've fallen behind. I think Representative Atkins said it best. And probably most acute are a group of widows that whose pensions are very, very modest. And what this legislation seeks to do is to remedy that problem. And in the there's a 13-page summary memo that PRA did. These officers and widows are live throughout the state. The biggest cohort is, and Representative Atkins referred to the number of 187 surviving spouse members. That would be widows whose pensions are less than $24,000 a year. The bill that was drafted calls for a $30,000 floor of respectability for them, but the staff has looked at this, PRA has looked at it, and to really isolate it to the group that we think needs some help, we would concur that the $24,000 level, which would be $2,000 a month, would be most appropriate. That's 187 surviving spouse, and they're really all around the state. And in fact, there's a huge concentration from the city of St. Paul of 53 of them, and this was at the time the study was done. In other words, almost a third are in that group. And when you think about it, these widows, husbands served, again, at some of the highest salaries in the state, but because of the plan design that provided an automatic surviving spouse benefit of 50% of what the member had, and when the members went, and some of those members actually got a better pension, but when the widow's pension was recalculated, it was calculated a much lower amount on the base salary. And they widows, if you will, did not get the benefit of the rise that happened in the PRA fund. And so, you know, $2,000 a month, and this is, I think of my mom, quite frankly. She's 90 years old in a nursing home, raised 8 children, shouldn't qualify for Social Security. These women, husbands, were not covered by Social Security. So not only did they perhaps not work in their career, but their husbands weren't covered by Social Security. And the only pension that these women have is what the legislature grants them through this process. And there's a big cohort in St. Paul, but if you look at the list, it's really every city in the state that would be affected by this. Albert Lea, Anoka, Austin, Bloomington, Duluth, Crystal, Fridley, Hibbing, Mankato, Red Wing, Richfield, Rochester actually has a pretty large group, South St. Paul, St. Cloud, St. Louis Park, Virginia, West St. Paul, Winona Police. And there is a cost to it, but the number that was associated with this group, I believe, for the to take care of the we had a kind of some shorthand here. At the 24,000 level to take care of this group of women would be about $2.9 million. That number, it's probably reduced because that was a study that was done a year ago, and this probably can't take effect for a while. There were 83 service pensioners, police officers whose pensions are below 38,000. There were 83 of those. That was $2.4 million. As I said, the total in that is $5.3 million. More likely, we're talking about men that are probably on the average age of the late 70s and women whose average age is 85 at the time this study was done. So it was $5.3 million, say, a year ago. Obviously, there's been some mortality in the meantime. And to put in context, I don't have the exact figures, but I think PRA Police and Fire's assets is about $7 billion. We're talking less than 0.1% that would address this issue. And as Representative Atkins identified, there's a source of funding. The memo from PRA indicates those dollars would come in far out years. But it really is a plea to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the commission, that this is a group that I do think we're not alleging that PRA made any mistakes or that someone did something wrong. I think when you look at this cohort of women, less than 24,000, all of these police officers would have served at least 20 years, probably 25 years of service. They're from around the state. It's really a plea for some level of equity. These cases are unusual in that the Pension Commission is asked to weigh in on this, but we do think there's a lot of merit to it. And given the complexity, I reviewed the memo again, and you know, Ms. Vanek actually, when she started with PRA, you know, over 30 years ago, or one of her duties was to handle all these consolidations. I was at some of those presentations. I think she did a good job. I think PRA did a good job, but you know, at one time or another, choices were made, and I do think there was a major flaw in the sense that the service pensioners were allowed to take escalation based on PRA, but the similar coverage was not granted to the widows or to the surviving spouses, that the members could have saw their pensions escalated, but that the surviving spouse pension was tied to an old 50% amount based on what the top patrol officers or firefighters' salary was. And I think that explains a big reason why the surviving spouses were left behind. And I think there are probably, quite frankly, in the 83 service pensioners, they may have made a bad choice. But when you look at a police officer who served the state for 20 or 25 years to have a pension, not in Social Security, have a pension below that level of, you know, $38,000, which would be about 80% of the average of the system, is really something that I guess we're just pleading the case and asking the Pension Commission to consider it. So I think that's about all I'd have to say on the topic.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. And with that, we have Shana Johnson from PERA, who is a testifier who has checked in here as well. So I'll invite her to come down if she would like to share some comments, as she is one of the testifiers that's on here today. At the risk of sounding cliche, she also brought her boss to work today. Ms. Jones, Mr. Anderson, welcome. If you will go ahead and state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, my name is Shana Jones. I'm the policy director at PERA.
And I'm Doug Anderson, executive director at PERA.
Before I ask the two of you to proceed with your testimony, just an update for commission members. We are not going to meet tomorrow, and what I'm going to do is the last three items that are on here, and if there are people who are present to talk about some of these kinds of things, staff and or other, we are going to carry those over to our next commission meeting agenda because there are more public policy kinds of things. We're losing members, and we also have some other members who have notified me that they need to leave. So I do want to get this taken care of today since we are in here, but we will not be taking any other information after today as a result of that. Mr. Johnson, Ms. Jones, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, PERA's involvement with the topic has been to provide data, as Mr. Rice indicated in the study that Mary Vanek completed very shortly before her retirement in 2015. Prior to 2015, PERA's involvement was reviewing and responding to a bill that was introduced in 2013 and then heard in 2014. And at that point in time, there was not funding attached to the bill. And so we opposed it, and the commission decided to have Ms. Vanek conduct the study that was presented to the commission. And so with that history, and I can answer any other questions. I know Ms. Lincheski had asked that maybe we provide a brief history. So if that's desired, we can certainly do that as well. But as it pertains to the proposal now before us, with the funding mechanism being the issue in the past, Mr. Anderson will provide some comments about our concerns on the funding mechanism being proposed this time around.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
With the funding issue, there is a fairly significant cost, and it does change from the previous study due to different participants. But also, there's new mortality rates that were reflected. So overall, looking at the cost estimates provided before and where they're at now, there's not a significant difference. And for the total group provided, it's in excess of $9 million. And the concern with funding is that with this change, there would be an immediate liability recognized. The actuary would reflect this in the funding valuation. It would be reflected in the accounting reports. But there's a deferred asset. The asset is recognized in the form of a contribution that would be coming at the end of a period that probably be about 35 years out in the future. If you look at the value of that, even if you were allowed to recognize that as a receivable, the value of that future contribution would be very low. And the issue there, too, is just the recognition, the immediate recognition of liability without being able to recognize an asset right away. So it creates an unfunded liability, which is really inconsistent with actuarial standards of practice, with GASB accounting, as well as the principles of the commission, which I think really summarize it really well in a point that says ad hoc post-retirement adjustments should be funded separately from regular defined benefit public pension plan financing and should not be added to the unfunded actuarial accrued liability. So in short, the funding issue is, while there may be a source identified, it's a very distant contribution and not able to be recognized at the moment.
Mr. Anderson, thank you. Are there other members of the public who would like to testify on the matter before the commission? Seeing none, members, questions for any of the testifiers? We're not going to take action on this, obviously, today, but we did want to get a hearing and put it in for consideration. So, members, questions for Representative Adkins, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Rice, or Ms. Jones? Seeing none and hearing none, thank you for your time. And we will do one other thing. The mayor from Harmon, Minnesota has come quite a distance, and I do want to take care of that issue today. So if you will all come down at this point, we'll take number 7. Again, not taking any action on it, but we certainly do want to hear the mayor's information and input here today. Welcome back, Auditor Otto, and Ms. Hennessy Allen. And I will ask you to go ahead and introduce yourselves, and then we'll bring the mayor in when it's the right time in the discussion, because I think you're probably going to be leading the conversation today, Auditor Otto.
Certainly.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand that there's not a quorum, this is our Volunteer Fire Relief Working Group bill, which we worked hard on, and I feel bad for the mayor of Harmony because he drove all the way here to be here today for the hearing from 1 to 4 o'clock. And he's a member of our Volunteer Fire Relief Working Group, so he wanted to be here to answer questions the members may have. There's almost no members left at this point. So it's a great bill, and I don't know if you can't even vote on it, if it's worth presenting it, but at least maybe give him a chance to how do you want to proceed?
I absolutely want to hear from the mayor because he was a part of the working committee on that, and he did come quite a distance, and that's important for the commission to have that information.
Yeah.
We're not going to take action on the bill, but again, if there's things that you'd like to be presenting that you want us to know at this point, and then at some point in the future, Auditor, we may have you back before the commission, but I'll defer to you on how you'd like to proceed with this part, if you would like to have the mayor or if you'd like to present. I'm flexible for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, rather than go through the whole thing, it's probably going to have to happen again. The mayor is also a member of the working group, and he's the president of the Harmony Relief Association. So he wears many hats. He's a phenomenal member of the group.
Can't hardly wait to hear from him.
I know. You know, he's very, very good. So anyway, maybe we give him a chance just to express his support for the work of the group, and we can come back and work on the detail, if that's okay.
That works for me. Mayor, thank you for your patience today and for coming in and being a part of this. These kinds of things do move slowly, but we hope to attempt to endeavor to get the right answer. So you own the floor right now. Go ahead and introduce yourself and then share your perspective, if you would, sir.
Thank you, Chairman and members. Like you've heard, I'm Steve Donnie, Mayor of Harmony. I am the president of our Firefighters Relief Association. I'm also on the ambulance, and the working group is always, before we make recommendations, it's a unanimous consent, so to speak. And I just wanted to come up in support of it and to show that and to state if there were any questions. Obviously, this will happen at a different time, so that's not an issue. I think these normally go through pretty smoothly because of the good work of the Office of the State Auditor. So I think that's all I would have to say.
Okay. Mayor, thank you again for your testimony and for your work on the Relief Association Board. We've got people who are being pulled in several different directions right now, and that's part of the product of the short session. I know that some members have to take off and to go to other meetings that are being held, and that's just kind of one of the natures of the beast, if you will, when we're looking at this. And so, again, I appreciate that. Questions for the mayor? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Donnie?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Donnie, we've heard that you're a part of the Fire Relief Association working group. I'm just wondering if you could describe the parameters or the membership of that working group and who's involved in that and when it originated.
So my position in there is advisory, I would say, and I am a member as a mayor, as a council member, city representative. I think I have a unique perspective because I'm also the president of the relief, so I could be a member of the group as a relief person, but I'm there representing the city.
So, Bayer, you're on the council, the mayor, and on the the ambulance service in your community?
Yes.
Do you live at City Hall? Or?
No, I have a job. I'm a financial advisor.
Oh, he's one of us all, right?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright.
Ms. Hennessy Allen, are you a participant in the Fire Relief Association Working Group?
Here. Mr. Chair, can I answer that, please?
I did ask Ms. Hennessy.
We'll give you a chance to respond, Representative Otto. Representative Albright, ask the question, Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Again, Rose Hennessy Allen, Pension Director at the Office of the State Auditor. Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not a member of the working group. I am a staff person and provide assistance and support.
Mr. General Albright.
Mr. Chair, Auditor Otto, could you, for me, then, describe the membership of the Fire Relief Association Working Group?
Auditor Otto.
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. So we have members from both the Metro and Greater Minnesota representing each plan type and the fire service organizations, as well as two municipal representatives. So Mr. Donnie serves as a municipal representative. And so we're really getting at big plans, small plans, you know, the DB, DC. And so in this community, to get laws changed, you have to make sure that everyone's in agreement. So the beauty of this working group has been that we get all the different perspectives and all the different needs, which can vary from different parts of the state, and we've tried to update the laws to meet the needs of the different communities. And what might be good for one community, when Senator Hayden asked, it might not be, another community might not want something. So quite often we'll make things permissive. But yeah, it's a really nice group, and we have people driving in from Greater Minnesota as well as Metro, and we just happen to have a really great member in Steve Donnie because he wears so many hats, and he's really an extraordinary member.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Auditor Otto.
Representative Albright, again, in the interest of time, we're going to lose other folks here.
Yep.
Is this close to or near your last question?
Second to last.
Proceed.
Thank you. I note, and actually, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if the folks from PARA might be prepared to also add. This will be my final question then. I note in the briefing that Ms. Barth prepared under point number one for a certification of service credit that it actually suggests an addition of a new section of to statute under 424A.003. And it goes on in the last couple of sentences in that first paragraph to describe the need for an additional certification measure taken on by the Office of the State Auditor, which is similar, and this is what I note, to Minnesota Statute 353G.07, which is performed by PARA. And so I'm in a quandary, if I'm reading this right, why there is an additional need to be duplicative in that, if I'm reading the code correctly.
Adorado.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, it's modeled after that language, but it's necessary because there's a small loophole right now in terms of people being able to get credit for both hours in para versus in the, there's a little tiny bit of double dipping that may be occurring for the exact same hours in para and in volunteers, and so it's a small loophole. It's necessary because of a court decision, the Hastings Fire Department versus State of Minnesota, and I have further information on that, and the court said that it's not clear and that the legislature could fix it. So we're just coming to make a little, it's a technical fix for a very small loophole that we think is important because we don't think the system was intended to be this way.
Representative Albright had also asked TRA
certification. Are you asking about the service credit requirement?
Yes.
That one. I apologize, because there's two different pieces for PARA. So the service credit certification, all we're doing in statute, there's something that folks have to do to PARA in terms of reporting. We want to create a formalized process where the fire chief does the certification and provides it both to the city and to the relief. There's not a formalized process right now, and we think it'd be extraordinarily beneficial based on some of the calls that we get. So again, it's just modeling the language, but something that the working group thought was a very important improvement and clarification and formalizing a process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not disagreeing that we want to make sure that there isn't duplication of effort here, but I'm actually wondering why then we would take that up under a new section in the statute as opposed to admonish PARA to combine that into their own certification. So I'm wondering if PARA would be willing to respond to my question.
We've got hands all over the place.
Mr. Chair, I think there's just a misunderstanding. The reporting for volunteer service hours are not reported to PARA. What gets reported to PARA are salaried hours, and these are rows.
Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Yeah, it's not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, so this wouldn't duplicate the reporting that's being done to PARA. What is being reported to PARA under 353G is service credit for volunteer firefighters who are in the statewide plan administered by PARA. What we're doing in this new section would be to create a similar type of reporting for volunteer fire relief associations that are still local associations. So that either if it's a local relief association, there would be a certification done to the association board. If the association had consolidated is in the statewide plan administered by PARA, the certification is done to PARA. So it's one or the other. It's not both.
Representative Albright, does that answer your question, or maybe we need to take this offline to have you visit more directly with the
right. I'm just wondering if I get a nod from PARA that they're understanding what this is.
I'm gonna, because we can't on audio record nods, and you're asking a question. I do need to bring PARA down to answer your last Ms. Jones, how long has it been since you've been before the commission? Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Shana Jones. I'm the policy director at PERA. Representative Albright, I do want to clarify, because this is not our bill, so I want to make sure I'm understanding. We are talking about...
No, Section 1. So it was modeled on language?
Okay. I'm not prepared to comment on Section 1. I could provide a comment on Section 2.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll take this offline with PARA and with the auditor and just verify that we're not duplicating. So thank you for that.
I endorse that idea. With that, members, we are adjourned.
Oh.
I thought I'd leave 10 minutes early.
Sorry.